Okay. The issue with Iran is a twofold problem in a way. Namely, they are strategically positioned to resist any effort to change their behavior on the one hand, and we'll talk about that later, why that is so. But the other thing is this is a place to test U.S. theories about democratization and so on. So there is a clash here that is really quite interesting, and we will be exploring that. Okay, before we talk about that, I want to prep you for the coming talks. We're changing the plan for next week to take advantage of an opportunity that's going to happen across the hall at 7 p.m. The Institute on Governmental Studies is going to have a panel on the U.S. presidency, Bush, and all of his problems, which is going to cover a lot of the topics that we've covered. And the panelists are going to be Nelson Polsby from Political Science, Michael Kinsley, the former opinion page editor of the LA Times, and the former editor of Slate, the online Microsoft publication. Michael Baroni, who's one of the leading opinion poll takers in Washington, and a man who follows trends in the U.S. And fourthly, Michael Duffy, who is the associate editor of Time magazine. So it's just a natural for that. The issue is it's at 7 o'clock. It's not during the class time. It will be webcast for those who can't make it. But I think it'll be really worth coming to hear because this is three Washington types who sometimes have a kind of a narrow vision of what's going on. And so it'll be a really interesting opportunity. So that's next week at 7 o'clock in 155. Because of the problems of climate change, I'm trying to arrange to have all these things right across the hall if you can make it. So it will be a panel, and it'll be worth seeing. Okay, then the week after that, we're also going to be in 155, Dwinelle, and our guest is going to be Larry Brilliant, a medical doctor who does a lot of work on global health issues. And interestingly enough, he has just been named the head of the Google Foundation. So here you will be hearing somebody who not only has worked on global health issues, recently especially avian flu, but who's in a position to shape the way we understand that problem. So that's on April 17th. It's 5 to 7. It's the Sanford Elberg Lecture, and it'll be in 155 Dwinelle across the hall. Okay? Then we've got two lectures coming after that. One of which I arranged, and I had no idea that it would be in the middle of a firestorm of controversy, but Steve Walt is going to be our guest. Steve Walt has just written an article with John Mersheimer on the Israeli lobby, which has created an unbelievable stir. He's talking about what went wrong with U.S. foreign policy, so the focus of his talk is not that article. But I'm sure he will welcome questions from you. So that's April 24th. And then the last lecture will be May 1st. And we're going to have Ian Lustig from the University of Pennsylvania, who has another controversial book coming out this summer from the University of Pennsylvania on U.S. foreign policy on the war on terror. And I've read the book, and it's quite an attack on the Bush strategy. And it does this through a comparison with Kennan's doctrine of containment, which defined our policy in the Cold War. So that's what's coming up, okay? So you know where you have to go. Next week, it's 7 in 155. The following week, it's 5 in 155. And then we'll, the last two classes will meet the regular time here. And the final exam is it will be in here during the last class. So that way we don't have to deal with people who need special arrangements. Okay, and we've graded the exams, and almost all of you did well. We'll post the grades after this class. Okay, so in preparation for our speaker today, I wanted to make two comments and then show you briefly a video. One of the things that I wanted to emphasize, and if I can go online, I will do that. it's just an obvious point that I wanted to make, which is once you finish this class, and assuming you don't want to forget everything you've learned about U.S. foreign policy, there's a good way to keep up with what's going on. And that's obviously going online to the leading newspapers, but more importantly, I think it's really important to use the blogs. And you can decide which blogs you want to use based on your ideology. I'm just going to point out a couple of them because one of the bloggers I have an interview with, and I'm going to show you a piece of that interview. So what I just want to show you, and we'll put them up on the website, very important one is one called TalkingPointsMemo.com by Jonathan Marshall. And he is following events in Washington, and within this, he has created a separate community of scholars talking about foreign policy. So that's one that I recommend. Another one that I want to recommend is a professor here in economics, Brad DeLong, whose blog has not been coming up, but Brad is an international economist. He worked for Larry Summers, and it hasn't come up. I think it's down for some reason. It's been down, but he's another person to follow in terms of international economic issues. There are others. I mean, if you're a conservative, you know, you can find William Buckley, you can find David Frum. I'm just saying that if you get in the habit of going to these sites, you can pick and choose what you want to read, and you can learn an awful lot, basically. And what I'm discovering is these blogs are like a day or 2 days ahead of the leading newspapers. And, of course, there's always the Financial Times, which I think is always ahead of the American papers. Brad DeLong's is not coming up. But the final one I wanted to show you, and then I'm going to show you a piece of an interview with the blogger. And he's a very interesting phenomenon, if I can find it. Yeah, informed comment. This is juancole.com. And I assigned his interview. Juan Cole is a professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Michigan. And he started blogging on the Iraq War right after the start of the war. And it is like a running account of what especially the Iraqi press and the world press are saying about what's going on in Iraq. He's left of center, but I think he's really interesting because he just in terms of what's going on and the comprehensive understanding. Juan Cole is a scholar of the Shias, basically. And there's a very interesting story which comes out in the interview. He was doing his dissertation on the Shias, and he couldn't get in anywhere because the Iran-Iraq war was going on. So he went to Lebanon and became a reporter, where he reported on the civil war there. And that's how he got into being a journalist at the same time that he was a scholar. Okay, now I'm going to show you a piece of my interview. And what we're talking about here is the following. One of the problems with the Islamic world, the Islamic Arab world, is the question of why hasn't that world embraced modernity in the way that the West did? It's a very complicated story, it is an important question because it may help us understand why our notions of democracy aren't applicable there. Now, of course, there's a problem with the way we're implementing democracy in Iraq and elsewhere because we think now that we can do it at the point of a gun. So what we've combined is Jacksonianism with Wilsonianism in Meade's terms. So that may be the reason why it's not working. But here, Cole and I are talking about what is going on in the Shia world that relates to this problem of tradition and modernity, and how can we help that riddle help us understand the search for nuclear weapons. So this is about a 20-minute excerpt. When we're finished, our guest speaker will be here, and at that point, I will introduce him. Now, let's see if this works. It should. Technology never works the way it's supposed to, but let's see if this works. I think we're going to have to raise the sound, or whether that's at my end. Let me see if that solves the problem. So we're going to have to raise the sound over here, I think. Oh, she's... Okay. Is that good? Can you hear that? Yeah.
But I think it does play a different role. And I think it does have to do with legislative.
Oh, perfect time. They don't even do that on theater. Well, now we'll get into the substance of these issues even more, and we're very pleased to welcome Dariush Zahidi, who's a lecturer in the political economy of industrialized societies, and who is, his doctorate is from UCLA, and he's his field is the strategic politics of the Persian Gulf and the Middle East area, and more importantly, he was visiting Iran. He is Iranian. Was arrested by the regime in circumstances that we will talk to him about after he does his presentation. And this required the university, the chancellor, the vice chancellor, and the deans to participate in the process of mobilizing support get our lecturer out, hopefully so he could be here today. Just kidding. He will offer us, I think, important insights into both the strategic position of Iran, the strategic relationship between us and the Iranians, and then the dynamic of the internal situation. So with that in mind, I guess.
Thank you, Harry. Especially since I was accused of espionage, you want to be careful with your with the contents of your computer. And let me begin by making a disclaimer, and that is that when it comes to the Middle East, we don't have any experts. We only have varying levels of ignorance. And since my ignorance is probably as much as anybody else's, then let me proceed to initially talk about three issues, and then I'll be happy to talk about internal Iranian politics afterwards. First of all, I want to talk about the motivations that Iran may have for achieving nuclear capability. Second of all, I would like to debunk this notion of the so-called mad mullah argument, that if Iran achieves nuclear capability, then they're going to utilize a nuclear weapon. They're going to use it against Israel. And then I would like to talk about U.S. options regarding Iran. First of all, as to motivations, I think the Islamic Republic of Iran has a number of rational motivations for achieving nuclear capability. First of all is the economic motivation. And as they correctly point out, prior to the Iranian Revolution of 1979, Iran used to produce at least 6 million barrels of oil per day, if not more, 6.5 million barrels. And at that time, the country itself consumed about 800,000 barrels of the 6 million that it produced. Today, the Islamic Republic of Iran produces at most 4.5 million barrels of oil per day. After Ayatollah Imam Khomeini came to Iran, he encouraged the Iranians to go forward and be fruitful and multiply, and the Iranian population responded in a very positive manner, so that the population of Iran has more than doubled in the course of the past 27 years. And if current trends continue, Iran will have no oil to export soon. So consequently, the country definitely does have economic motivations for achieving nuclear capability. But much more importantly are the strategic variables. And here we have to recognize that Iran lives in a very dangerous neighborhood, that it is surrounded by powers which are hostile largely to the Islamic Republic, and many of these powers do have nuclear capability, particularly Israel, which has come to view Iran as its strategic competitor in the Middle East, and also Pakistan. Pakistan, which is a largely Sunni country and has absolutely no ideological affinities with Iran, which is a Shia country. But more importantly is the position of the United States. Because of the ouster of the Taliban and because of the American invasion of Iraq, Iran now is also neighbors with the United States, and the Islamic Republic feels that it is becoming encircled by the United States. The United States is already in Afghanistan. It has 150,000 troops in Iraq. And also the U.S., we should remember, is for all practical purposes the predominant power in the Persian Gulf. There's a great debate between the Iranians and the Arabs as to whether we should refer to this body of water as the Persian Gulf or the Iranian Gulf. And I, being from Iran, obviously favor the Iranian Gulf. And historically, it has also been the Iranian Gulf up until the 1950s when Tamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt began referring to it as the Arabian Gulf. But no matter what you want to call this body of water, Persian or Arab, increasingly it is neither. Increasingly, it has come to resemble an American lake. With the American Fifth Fleet controlling the body, this very strategic waterway. And the United States, of course, has definitely made no secret of its animosity towards Iran. Most recently, the United States has adopted the policy of regime change in Iran. And only a few days after the collapse of Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq, I believe it was Richard Pearl who said that while it's good to go to Baghdad, real men want to go to Tehran. Okay? And there is absolutely no doubt that there are significant and powerful elements within this administration and without the administration, outside of the administration, who in my estimation correctly view Iran as the primary strategic prize in the Middle East. So it makes sense for Iran, and as was pointed out, I just walked in and I heard Juan Cole talking about the three members of the Axis of Evil. You saw what happened to Iraq, and we saw what has happened or not happened to North Korea, and the Iranians have made the appropriate deductions. They would like to emulate the example of North Korea, and they would like to do so in order to deter a preemption, to preempt a preemption. That's why Iran is interested. If they are indeed interested in nuclear weapons, it's for deterrence purposes. They, I think, are definitely attempting to acquire the infrastructure for building nuclear weapons, and then when they deem the time to be appropriate, they would weaponize their nuclear program. But as I said, I don't think that Iran, even if it does achieve nuclear capability, even if it does build a bomb, it will never use it against any country, least of all Israel. They want it solely for deterrence purposes. Why? Because since the inception of the Islamic Republic, this regime has said that it stands for the rights of the oppressed people in the world. And it says that the Palestinian people are the oppressed people par excellence. And therefore, we should assist the Palestinians. But unless Iranian scientists manage to come up with a nuclear device that can distinguish between Palestinians and Jewish inhabitants of either Israel or the occupied territories. They are not going to use this against Israel. Another reason why the Iranians say that they are interested in the Palestinian-Israeli issue is because of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is a sacred place for the Muslims, and the Islamic Republic has said from its very inception that Jerusalem should be controlled by Muslims. But if Iran was to use a nuclear device against Israel, then you have to kiss Jerusalem goodbye. Vaporize the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And this is something which the rulers of the Islamic Republic are not particularly interested in achieving. And then last but definitely not least, what is Israel going to do to Iran? What is the international community going to do to Iran? What is the United States going to do to Iran if Iran indeed does use its nuclear bomb against Israel? So, I don't believe that the Islamic Republic, even if it acquires nuclear capability, would ever use this capability against its neighbor. I also wanted to talk about American options in regards to Iran. And when it comes to dealing with Iran, I believe that America's options range from bad to very bad to horrible. First of all, the issue of invading Iran is definitely out of the question. Iran is three times the size of Iraq. It has three times the population of Iraq. And it has not been under debilitating sanctions for the past 15 years. Iran is also, unlike Iraq, one of the oldest civilizations in the world. It is not an artificial entity created by colonial powers in the aftermath of the First World War. And so, therefore, the sense of nationalism in Iran is very strong and highly palpable. Beyond that, the United States is not in a position to launch an invasion of Iran at this time. The U.S. is overstretched militarily, financially, diplomatically, and otherwise. So this then leaves the possibility of strategic strikes against Iran's nuclear installations. But strategic strikes themselves may not be such a good option after all. Because the Iranians definitely have learned from the experience of Iraq in 1981 when Israel bombed the Ozirak nuclear power plant in Iraq. And as a result of this, the Iranians have taken care to disperse, to conceal, and to replicate their nuclear installations so that strategic strikes may not really set back, may not substantially or even moderately set back Iran's nuclear program. To the contrary, if the U.S. does indeed, the U.S. or Israel do indeed engage in strategic strikes, this may actually prompt the Iranians to redouble their efforts to achieve nuclear capability. Again, we know from the example of Iraq in 1981 that after Israel bombed the Ozirak nuclear power plant, Saddam definitely accelerated Iraq's attempts to achieve nuclear capability as well as nuclear arms. Prior to the Ozirak strike, there were about 500 Iraqis engaged in the task of achieving nuclear capability. After the Ozirak strike, Saddam increased the number of Iraqis trying to build the bomb from 500 to 7,000 individuals. And this, in my estimation, is also likely to happen in the case of Iran. Moreover, Iran would definitely leave the NPT and would stop allowing inspectors from the IAEA to inspect Iran's facilities. Moreover, Iran now is in a position to retaliate. And I believe that the Islamic Republic would definitely retaliate should either the United States or Israel launch military strikes against nuclear targets in Iran. In part because of the United States ouster of the Taliban and Saddam's regime, Iran's geopolitical and strategic position in the Middle East, in the Persian Gulf region, have become much more enhanced. Iran is definitely in a position to wreak havoc in Iraq, to destabilize Iraq even further. And already, Iranian intelligence forces and operatives have infiltrated Iraq, and they can create another insurgency or assist the ongoing insurgency, an insurgency which would be much larger in scale and scope than what's going on in Iraq today. So Iran can definitely create mischief in Iraq. It has many cards to play in Iraq. You have to remember that during the time, during the rule of Saddam Hussein, it was Iran which supported all of the Shia oppositional forces to Saddam's regime. Iran can also make trouble not just in Iraq, but also in Afghanistan. Iran has 700 miles of common border with Afghanistan, and particularly in the western Afghani province of Herat, Iranians are very well positioned and situated to make trouble for the United States. There are elements within the Islamic Republic who may also decide to go into a tactical alliance with Al-Qaeda and make common cause with their Sunni rivals against the United States. So in Iraq, in Afghanistan, Iran can retaliate, but also, and just as significantly, in the Persian Gulf region, wherever there are Shia minorities or even Shia majorities, Iran is well positioned to make trouble for the United States. And there are Shias scattered throughout the Persian Gulf region. In Bahrain, for instance, Bahrain is ruled by a Sunni dynasty, but the majority of the Bahrainis are Shia. And it is also in Bahrain where the United States Fifth Fleet is stationed. Bahrain has Shias. There are Shias in Kuwait and the United Arab Emirates. But much more significantly, perhaps, there are Shia. There is a distinctive Shia minority in Saudi Arabia. And the significance of the Shia minority in Saudi Arabia, a minority which has perennially been discriminated against by the Wahhabis, minority which has been marginalized politically, economically, socially, religiously, is that the Shias in Saudi Arabia live in the very sensitive eastern province of the kingdom, the Al-Hasa province. And it is in the Al-Hasa province where virtually all of Saudi Arabia's oil facilities, installations, and resources are located. And I wonder what is going to happen to the price of oil if a few oil installations in the Al-Hasa province are blown up. So Iran can retaliate in the Persian Gulf region. It is also well positioned to retaliate in Lebanon, beyond the Persian Gulf region. You have to remember that it was the Islamic Republic of Iran which helped play the predominant role in the founding and in the funding of Hezbollah. And there are elements within Hezbollah which are beholden to the Islamic Republic. Hezbollah is armed with thousands of Katusha rockets that it can launch in Israel, and it can destabilize Lebanon. The position of Hezbollah in Lebanon actually has become enhanced since the Syrians withdrew their troops from Lebanon. So in Lebanon, in Israel, potentially also in Palestine, Iran has been a major supporter of Islamic Jihad, and it could create mischief in all of these areas. And we have to remember that Hezbollah is a political grouping, some would say a terrorist grouping, whose global reach is probably wider than the reach of Al-Qaeda. So Hezbollah could also potentially create difficulties, not just in the Middle East region, but also beyond. Another consequence of launching strategic strikes against Iran would be that it would set back the democratization effort in Islamic Republic greatly. There are groups in the Iranian ruling elite who want nothing more than strategic strikes against nuclear installations. If you believe that there are some warmongers in the current administration in the United States, then you should get to meet Ayatollah Jannati, who is the Secretary of the Council of Guardians in Iran. I think particularly the people associated with Ahmadinejad, the security establishment in the Islamic Republic, wants the United States or Israel to launch strikes, and this will give them the opportunity to crush the remnants of Iran's civil society. And to talk about civil society in Iran is not a contradiction in terms. Even today, the Islamic Republic of Iran is relatively more open and pluralistic than many of its neighbors. So they would crush, as they say, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. And Iran, of course, is the one-eyed man in this area. They would crush the remnants of civil society, rally the people behind the flag, and would utilize the opportunity to eliminate their rivals within the regime and outside of the regime. So it would be very good for them. Also, and definitely the Islamic Republic is not about to collapse just because the United States will launch military strikes against nuclear targets in Iran. Moreover, not only would this set back Iran's attempts at democratization, we also have to remember that Iran is unique in the Middle East, indeed in the Muslim world, in the sense that Iran is probably the only country in the Muslim world in which the masses do not at this time harbor anti-American sentiments. To the contrary, the Iranian street probably is relatively pro-American at the moment. And there are causes for this. First of all, you can accuse the mullahs of many things, but being beholden to the United States is not one of them. Okay? This regime has definitely not been beholden to the United States, unlike America's allies in the Middle East, which undermine the human rights of their citizens, subjects, and are perceived as doing the bidding of the United States. Moreover, Iranians are not Arabs. The vast majority of Iranians are not Arabs. So although they may feel some sympathies for the Palestinians, all right, the Palestinian issue is not an issue of overriding concern for the vast majority of the Iranian population. Actually, many citizens of Iran believe that the Islamic Republic has gone too far in promoting the interests of the Palestinians. And you encounter people in the Iranian street who say, why should we elevate the interests of the Palestinians above our own national interests? Some people even go so far as to say, the hell with the Palestinians. So, Iranians are not Arabs. And also you have to remember that there was no love lost between Iran and Saddam Hussein. Most Iranians were delighted to see the end of the Ba'ath regime in Iraq. And because of these reasons now, they are harboring somewhat pro-American sentiments. But if the United States begins to bomb the hell out of Iran, then I assure you that these pro-American sentiments would dry up rather rapidly. And also, launching military strikes against Iran would further fuel the Muslim rage against the United States. I think the key issue here, and I think that to the extent that the Iranians are interested in achieving nuclear capability or even nuclear weapons, if what I say is correct, that they want to achieve nuclear capability in order to deter an American intervention, then it stands to reason that Iran and the United States should be talking to each other, and they should attempt to resolve their differences through diplomatic means. And I think Iran would definitely go the nuclear route. It would be remiss of the ruling elite in Iran not to go the nuclear route, so long as it has not received the appropriate security guarantees from the United States. Not from the European trio and not from Russia or China, but from the United States. So the key to the resolution of this issue is in the hands of the U.S., and the United States and Iran should be discussing the issue together, diplomatically. I think I can stop now and answer your questions.
Visiting the country, visiting your brother who is there.
I was at the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong people. This was in 2003, in the summer of 2003, when Saddam's regime had just collapsed in a matter of very short time. Prior to that, the Taliban had fallen, and the ruling clique in Iran was very much concerned, anxious, and apprehensive. And this was at a time when this notion of regime change through conquest had not as yet become discredited. So, and the neocons were openly talking about who's next. And some of them had said that real men want to go to Tehran and so on and so forth. So the regime was extremely nervous. And also my visit to Iran coincided with the anniversary of the 1999 student uprising in the Islamic Republic. At this time, I met with a number of prominent secular intellectuals. Some of them were dissident intellectuals belonging to the National Front, which is the political party of the late Prime Minister Mossadegh. And I suppose I should not have. I thought it would be okay because these individuals were free themselves. They were even publishing articles in Iranian newspapers. I talked about Iranian civil society. And they were also consulting with the reformist elements within the Islamic Republic, so I thought that my meeting with them would not arouse much suspicion and would be innocuous. Obviously, I had made a mistake, and I think that probably there were some informants in the homes of these individuals who notified the Ministry of Intelligence, and that's why I was arrested. That's true. I was arrested initially by the Iranian Ministry of Intelligence, which operated nominally under the government of President Khatami, the former reformist president of Iran. And the Ministry of Intelligence was undoubtedly the most right-wing ministry in Khatami's cabinet, but nonetheless, Khatami had selected the Minister of Intelligence. But after 40 days, 37 days actually, of solitary confinement and being put through a very rigorous process of interrogation every day almost, and at the same time the ministry conducting its own research into my background, the ministry came to the conclusion that I was innocent. I should say that I was accused of espionage and fomenting instability, seeking to undermine the national security of the Islamic Republic through espionage and fomenting instability, which are extremely serious charges anywhere, especially in Iran.
Before we go on,
It came out of the blue. I had no idea that this was about to happen. I went to my brother's office early in the morning, as I had been doing in the past month that I had been living in Iran. And once I arrived, I discovered that my brother was standing at the door to the office, and there were two burly, scary-looking, bearded individuals next to him. And my brother told me that the gentleman wanted to have a few words with you. I said, fine. We went upstairs. We discussed some issues over tea. And one of the less scary-looking gentlemen said that, Doctor, talking to me, I want you to accompany us. There is a judge who wants to ask you a few questions. Apparently, there were some issues in terms of you obtaining an exit visa. I said, sir, Hajaga. Hajaga means you call everyone Hajaga. Haji is the person who's made the annual pilgrimage to Mecca. So members of the Islamic Republic like to be referred to as Hajaga. He said, Hajaga, I have a luncheon appointment. He said, oh, don't worry about it. This shouldn't take more than a couple of hours, at most. So that's how I was arrested. And then they took me and they drove me to my house, to my mother's house, actually, which is the place that I was staying there at the time. They inspected it, and thereafter I was taken to the Evin prison, which is the most notorious prison in Tehran.
Interrogated every day, what?
It depends on, as your former president used to say, it depends on what is. I was not physically assaulted. Physically, I was not tortured. And in a way, I got lucky because a few days prior to my arrest, a Canadian-Iranian photojournalist by the name of Zahra Kazemi had also been arrested and taken to the same prison, but she apparently had decided to question her interrogators, and she had been tortured, beaten to death. So I think, this, once it became public, it was a horrendous public relations fiasco for the Islamic Republic, and the authorities didn't want it to be replicated. And so for whatever reason, I also cooperated with them fully to the extent possible. But I was not tortured physically, but I was put under a lot of mental, emotional, psychological pressure.
So what was the day like? How many hours did you question?
I was held in two different detention centers. As I said, initially I was cleared by the Ministry of Intelligence Detention Center, but then the Iranian Prosecutor General, and here we go back to the...
So this is the dual track.
In an unprecedented move, the Prosecutor General refused to accept the recommendation of the Ministry of Intelligence, which was astounding. So after 2 months in the ministry detention center, I was transferred to another detention center inside Evin prison also, but this one belonging to the Revolutionary Guards. I would say that my treatment, the treatment meted out to me in the intelligence ministry, was more humane. My interrogators were kinder and gentler than the ones in the Revolutionary Guards detention center. But obviously, initially, I was shocked and astounded, didn't know what was about to happen to me, and I feared for the worst. And I was in prison for 4 months. I spent 101 days in solitary, 23 days in the public area of the Ministry of Intelligence's detention center. Solitary was horrendous, as you can imagine. The public area was much better. There were other people, interesting people, political prisoners, economic prisoners that I could speak with, interact with.
This was in the first.
This was in the first, yes. Yes.
So I visited a lot of the political prisoners, and I want to ask you, what kept you going? I mean, in other words, it's a matter of a kind of personal survival, like I said, what you were alone. So what kept you going to stand your ground and survive?
I knew that I had done nothing wrong, and I was prepared to defend myself, and I indeed did so. But at a certain point, I was no longer able, actually, to keep going. I was about to give up because my interrogators at the ministry had told me that I'm about to be released. After 50 days, they took me for questioning. Their behavior improved. They started to treat me with dignity. Then they sent me to the public area of the prison. They allowed me to have meetings with my family members, to have phone calls. And I was told by the other prisoners that once they bring you here and they place no restrictions on your contact with the outside world, then all of these are good signs. So I thought I was about to be released. Then they came one day, they called my name, they blindfolded me, as usual, took me out, and everybody assumed, including I, assumed that I would be released. But then they took me to this other detention center, again in solitary conditions, far worse than the first. And my interrogator changed. He didn't show up for 2 weeks. And then once he came, he didn't have any kind words to say to me. After a while, I was about to give up. Fortunately, I didn't. But I came very perilously close to making a stupid false confession. Because he kept on telling me that we know that the intelligence forces sent you here. I want you to tell me what your mission was, how much of it you've accomplished, what remains to be done. Otherwise, I'm going to keep you here for as long as it takes. It tells me, it showed me that the Iranian system is a system which is characterized by fragmentation, factionalism. There are definitely competing centers of power, at the time even more so than today. And so I was unfortunately able to glimpse and to feel the factional infighting. I became a victim of it. So I have certainly developed an appreciation for the divisions inside Iran's ruling elite.
And is this a division? Because before you came in, Juan Cole was talking about the division between the guarantee and tradition and so on. Is there any further characterization of these two factions that you could give us? Because it seems that it was irrelevant what you had done or who you were. You were an object that they could.
Yes. I am, of course, much more favorable towards the reformist faction. But I suppose if you wanted to generalize, you could say that the reformers are the modernist element within the Islamic Republic. They are. And it was the task of the reformers to try to improve the Islamic Republic, to make the system more compatible with modernity, with democracy, with pluralism. But regrettably, they failed to do so in their endeavor. And they failed in large measure because of the so-called conservative faction. And there are divisions within the conservative faction, and there are divisions within the reformist faction. But they failed. for a number of reasons. I think once my case became publicized and the Iranian authorities had always warned my family not to go public with the case. But once the case became publicized, it certainly worked to my advantage. And it became publicized not because my family publicized it, but again because of the factional infighting. This time, a reformist member of parliament went public with it. And I am very grateful to that individual. I don't know what his motivations were. It could be that, as you pointed out, he was trying to score points against his adversaries. That probably had a lot to do with it, actually, because he said that we know of this academic Iranian-American who has been cleared by the Ministry of Intelligence, and yet the prosecutor general refuses to let him go. And we are afraid that the same thing that happened to the lady, to the Canadian-Iranian photojournalist, may happen to him. And once the case became public, then my family had no longer had any compunctions. And then they encouraged the university to come to my aid. And I think it was instrumental. The publicity surrounding the case was instrumental. Fortunately.
How can an outside group or entity affect the individual case in Iran and more generally the evolution of the case?
Well, my case was unique. It was unique in the sense that I became extremely unlucky that I was arrested in the first place, but then a fortuitous set of events came together which prompted the authorities to release me. First and foremost, I was innocent, and they knew that I was innocent. They had nothing against me. Second, fortunately, I did not make a false confession. Third, the case was publicized, and in light of the fact that the Canadian-led lady had been killed, they didn't want to have any additional negative publicity. And fourth was the fact that Shirin Ebadi had just been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, the Iranian human rights lawyer and activist. And the international community was focusing on the human rights record of Iran. And also at the time, Iran was negotiating with the European trio, Britain, France, and Germany, over its nuclear program. And I think it wanted to project a positive image of itself at that time. So all these factors came together, which prompted them to release me. Otherwise, I don't think. And also, there were a number of prominent people within the ruling elites who were working on my behalf, overtly and covertly. So general lessons would be difficult to draw from this. But obviously, one general lesson is that they do care about their human rights, about their image in the outside world. They're certainly not preoccupied about it. And if they believe that their national interests dictate for them to do so, they don't hesitate in violating it. But nonetheless, they don't want to have additional negative publicity.
More
I would respond by saying that it's exceedingly unlikely for the Iranians, for the Iranian regime, to provide any terrorist organization with nuclear weapons, for the simple reason that if the terrorists then turn around and utilize this nuclear weapon, ultimately people are going to find out that the weapon was given to them by Iran. And the Islamic Republic, like any other regime, above all else, they're interested in survival. Regime survival is paramount for the ruling elite in the Islamic Republic. And one could make the argument, and I did make the argument, that to the extent that they're interested in nuclear weapons is for maximizing their survival, to preempt the preemption, okay, and to guard against regime change from without. So given the fact that they're interested above all in survival, I think it would be exceedingly stupid of them to provide this weapon to terrorist groups, because sooner or later it will be discovered. Another argument that is made is that if Iran goes nuclear, then this will trigger an arms race in the region, and then Saudi Arabia would want to achieve nuclear capability. Turkey would want to have nuclear weapons, Egypt would want to have nuclear weapons, and so on and so forth. This, I think, is a more persuasive case. But we have to remember that Turkey is a member of NATO and is a staunch and close ally of the United States and is already provided with the nuclear umbrella by NATO and by the United States. And Saudi Arabia would also be protected, I think, by the nuclear shield of the United States. Well, the Iranian military, in spite of the fact that they may or may not have invented the fastest underwater missile, is certainly no match for the military of the United States. And the United States definitely does have the capability to annihilate Iran's military infrastructure if it is so inclined to do so, and Iran's civilian infrastructure. And the Iranian Navy obviously is no match for the Navy of the United States. What Iran can do, which is potentially more menacing, as I mentioned earlier, is that the Islamic Republic could create mischief for the United States. All right? Interfere with the free flow of shipping in the Persian Gulf. Create mischief in Saudi Arabia, fan the flames of the insurgency in Iraq, create disaster in Afghanistan, make matters much worse in the Israel-Palestine issue. Okay? So indirectly, yes, the Islamic Republic of Iran is well positioned to make life extremely difficult, not just for the United States, but for everyone, but especially for the United States, as well as its European allies and for Israel. But Iran militarily is definitely no match for the United States. And again, because it's no match conventionally for the United States, all the more reason to achieve nuclear capability, to deter any kind of potential intervention, and to maximize regime survival. Well, the Iranian Shias and the Iraqi Shias have intimate ties with one another. For most of history, the centers of Shia Islamic learning were located in present-day Iraq, in Najaf, and in Karbala. After the Ba'athist seizure of power in Iraq, then they began to move to Iran, to Qom. There are definitely affinities between Iran, both religious institutions in Iran and political institutions in Iran, and political Shia groupings in Iraq as well as religious groupings in Iraq. You have to remember that the most prominent Ayatollah in Iraq, if not the Muslim world, Grand Ayatollah Sistani, is not an Iraqi. He's an Iranian who speaks Arabic with a Persian accent. Okay? So Iran does have intimate ties to the Iraqi Shias, but at the same time, there's the issue of the Persian-Arab divide. During the Iran-Iraq War, most of the Shias remained loyal to Saddam Hussein. They remained loyal because had they not remained loyal, probably they would have been executed. But nonetheless, they remained loyal. So there is Persian-Arab split, but at the same time, the regime has many intimate ties to the Shias inside Iraq. The ties are more intimate between some Shias and the Iranian government, and the Iranian government is well positioned to take advantage of its ties with these groups, which it supported, as I said, during the rule of Saddam Hussein. This is true. Ayatollah Khomeini believed in the notion, in the doctrine of rule by the religious jurist, or velayat faqih. And historically, there's been a great debate within Shia Islam as to whether the clerics should or should not rule. And most prominent Ayatollahs have sided with Sistani. They have believed that Shia clerics should not directly become engaged in the government of society, first and foremost because if they become engaged, then they're likely to be blamed for the ills afflicting society, and this may derogate the prestige of the Shia establishment, and much more importantly, it may undermine the position of Islam itself. And Ayatollah Sistani is not, to the extent that we know, he's not in favor of the concept of velayat faqih, but he is definitely in favor of having a role for Islam and for Islamic law, the Sharia, in the Iraqi constitution. And he wants the Sharia to be a significant component of Iraqi law. And in southern Iraq, where the Shias are ruling, they are, for all practical purposes, enforcing the Sharia. Iran definitely is a heterogeneous country, and although 85% of the population of Iran are Shias, talking about religious sectarian heterogeneity, yeah, more than 85% are Shias, but we also have significant Sunni minorities in Iran, especially in the border areas, in Iranian Kurdistan, as well as in Iranian Baluchistan, and some Iranian Arabs in the south are Sunni. Many of them are Shia, but some of them are Sunni. And then you also have the Baha'is, and the Baha'is are probably the most persecuted religious group in Iran. Actually, the Islamic Republic does not recognize the Baha'i faith as a religion, as a full-fledged religion, because the Baha'is say that the hidden 12th Imam, the Shia Messiah, came back in the 19th century and he made some modifications to the original teachings of the Prophet. So the Baha'is are viewed as heretics for all practical purposes. But we also, there are also Christians in Iran and Jews in Iran. The situation of the Christians is probably better. The Jews don't have it so easily in Iran. Prior to the revolution, there were more than 100,000 Jews in Iran. Most of them have left Iran now and migrated to Westwood and Beverly Hills, not to Israel. But still, Iran has the largest number of Jews in the Middle East. Still, there are 25 to 30,000 Jewish people living in Iran. They are allowed to have their representative in the Iranian parliament, and they can operate synagogues and so forth. But they are perceived as having dual loyalties, so it's difficult for them. The Iranian regime says that we are not anti-Semitic, although if you listen to Ahmadinejad, you may think otherwise. They say that we're not anti-Semitic, we're anti-Zionist, okay? As far as the impact of increasing pressure on the plight of religious minorities, you're asking about religious minorities, not ethnic minorities. In Iran, I think the fact that Iran is under the spotlight probably will prompt them to be more careful. Although, since the regime is fragmented and divided, and there are even different elements within the conservative faction now, some of them are much more extremist, and they could care less about Iran being under the spotlight. And they would do what they deem to be necessary and essential, as indeed they've done. Even though Iran is under the spotlight, the conservative and elements within the conservative faction has began to crack down on certain branch of the Sufis, who are mystics, Islamic mystics, in the holy city of Qom. May I say also one more thing about Iranian minorities? Just as Iran could create mischief, I forgot to mention this, for the United States could also potentially create mischief for Iran by playing the ethnic card, especially the Sunni ethnic card or the Arab ethnic card. There are 2 million Arabs, Iranian Arabs, living in the sensitive province of Khuzestan, which is where most of Iran's oil installations is located. And the ethnic groups, particularly the Kurds, the Arabs, and the Baluchis, have not been integrated fully into Iranian society, politics, or economy. And the U.S. could also play on this ethnic diversity in Iran. But this is a very dangerous game, actually, in my opinion, because it could get out of control and come to further destabilize the entire region. If Iran becomes destabilized and is fragmented, it's not going to be confined within Iranian territory. It would be spilling out of Iranian borders and affecting Turkey, Syria, Pakistan, the Persian Gulf region. Actually, we have already favored Iran a great deal. Iranians are very happy. Things are going Iran's way. The U.S. is stuck in Iraq in a quagmire. It's not in a position to seriously threaten the survival of the Islamic Republic. It has eliminated two of the most significant rivals of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Saddam in Iraq and the Taliban in Afghanistan. And the Shias are, by virtue of the fact that they're the majority in Iraq, no matter what kind of government is established there, they're going to be in a predominant position. And if the U.S. leaves Iraq, Iran definitely does want the United States to withdraw its forces from Iraq. But then this may open the hands of the United States. If Iraq is stabilized, it may open the hands of the United States to concentrate more fully on the Iranian issue. So on the one hand, Iran does not want to see what's going on in Iraq to spiral out of control, or the civil war in Iraq, which is in its incipient stages, to become even worse because it could spill into Iran. On the other hand, so long as it has not come to terms with the United States, it does not want the U.S. to be happy and content either. Okay? I think Iran could help the United States to stabilize Iraq, provided the other issues that separate Iran from the United States are also addressed. Otherwise, they have little incentives and motivations to help the United States extricate itself from Iraq easily.
With all of his power. regional hegemon from arising in that part of the world, but by failing in implementing the invasion and occupation, he has created the rise of Iran, which is now the unquestioned regional hegemon, unless things go differently. Do you have a comment on that?
I agree. And that's in part why the people who came up with this document, which was so controversial that it had to be withdrawn at that time, that's why many of them are also interested in Iran. That's why real men want to go to Tehran, because the Persian Gulf region is a very vital strategic region. It contains 70% of the world's known petroleum resources. And every country in the world, including the United States, is, like it or not, going to become more dependent on this region for its petroleum needs. And another rising power, China, is also increasingly dependent upon the Persian Gulf region. And Iran has the longest coastline on the Persian Gulf and on the Arabian Sea. And it's the only country in the world which connects the Persian Gulf region to the Caspian Sea basin, another emerging significant geopolitical region in the world. So it makes sense to have a pliant state, pliant regime in Iran, and then if the need arises, to use it against a rising and recalcitrant China. Hopefully the need is not going to arise. And also the neocons look wistfully upon the time of the Shah, with Iran and Israel being the two primary non-Arab countries in the Middle East. And they maintain that these two countries do share common interests. What is preventing them from improving ties is the ideology of the Islamic Republic. Once we remove the Islamic Republic, then you can have what we had during the time of the Shah. So I agree.
Before I thank our guests, which I will do in a second, I just want to remind you that next week we're going to meet at 7 in 155 DNL. Also, after the class, we'll be posting the grades. We'll be posting out there. Or?